Welcome to episode 38 of the Island CT podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT podcast. So
we're recording on the June 15th.
Oops. Fix our notes.
Yep. Okay.
And this is probably going to be a really short one. I don't think we have any administrative stuff.
We don't. Not this week.
We've been really busy with other stuff, so.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So, what do you want to do?
How about we start with some ecology?
Sure.
Okay. So, I have two articles that I thought were quite interesting. One was on coral.
Which one is that?
It is a few genetic tweaks may help coral survive change.
Got it.
And it's just a very brief article. It was written by Madeline Sophia on June 14th. And
this is out of Science.
This is out of Science in their news section. And it talks about in the coral reef, they're experiencing a lot of coral bleaching. However, they've also found that there's a variation among the algae that is surviving the bleaching events,
mm-hmm.
and that they have a slight genetic difference. And it's just, I thought it was a pretty cool release about, when they compared the genes of the two, they realized that one is more heat resistant than the other.
Did they mention any of the particular genes in the news piece?
They didn't. This is just a brief. So normally they post these as a new finding.
Uh-huh.
And then in the next science magazine, they usually have an article to follow it up. So I just thought it was a cool.
Is this out of the Great Barrier Reef?
Yes.
Okay, so this we is talked. Out.
Yeah. So we talked about it, and they said, 93% of the Australia's Great Barrier Reef is now experiencing some level of coral bleaching. And so the team of researchers started to compare, the groups that were bleaching, the groups that weren't, and they looked at the algae, and the ones that did well with the higher temperature. And they found that there is a heat-resistant algae turned on several genes associated with stress resistance.
Right.
And so I'm looking forward to hearing more about it seeing what their finding is in the future. So I just wanted a brief mention. It wasn't a huge article.
Yep.
So what do you have?
I don't have any, I don't really have any ecology type ones at all. I have one, kind of, but not really.
Okay. I have one more.
Okay.
It's pretty cool. And this is looking at seals, and I just have to find my notes.
Is that in the notes you sent me?
Yes, they are. So, it's a race. The article is called A Race to Vaccinate Rare Seals. And this is in the June 10th issue of Science.
I saw and it. I just didn't have time to look at it.
It's just a fun article. So, it brings back a bunch of, terms like, herd immunity and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And they are in the mode right now of trying to save the Hawaiian monk seal. And they have, right
Where's,
now.
Is this?
In Hawaii.
It is in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Okay.
And right now there's an outbreak of foreseen distemper virus, the PDV, and it's a major killer of seals in general. And what they're trying to do is to get out there and to vaccinate the seals.
Do they say how they go about it physically?
Physically, they have a large pole.
And then just stab them. Okay, that'll work.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, the 20-foot pole. And they stab the seal.
Yeah.
And they creep up on them as they're asleep on the shore.
Oh, man.
And then
hit
them with the vaccine. And they said that, you know, they growl and get all upset. And then they fall back to sleep after they've been vaccinated. So it's not too upsetting for them. But here's the crazy thing. So, you know, they're trying to save these seals. These seals' population is very low. In fact, they're the most endangered marine species right now. So,
did they mention what's the population of that species?
So, at one place, they mentioned that in Oahu, they have 43 known monk seals.
Okay.
And they think that they've roughly vaccinated 26.
Okay, and they're still trying to vaccinate.
And they're still going around to vaccinate. And here's the trick. It's not good enough to vaccinate them once. You have to go back in another week and vaccinate those same ones again.
Ah.
So they're
just the nature of that vaccine.
Yeah. So it's a two-dose vaccine.
Bummer.
So, yeah, it is a bummer. So they're going around vaccinating and then revaccinating a group and hoping they're getting them. And this is the first time this has ever been done. And so it's an interesting, I'm curious to find out, first of all, how many they vaccinate in the end, and then how effective it was.
And the strategy.
Yeah.
Like, you can imagine if you have, when I heard 40 some, I'm like, oh wow, you could try to vaccinate every single one.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you had several hundred, you might have to do some kind of calculation. Okay, what's the percentage we need to hit in order for the distemper to stop spreading from one individual to another?
And for their population, they need 80%.
Yeah. They need 80%.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. So it is a lot, but then they have a relatively small population.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a race against time for these people. And I just thought it was just a very cool and interesting article. Oh, there we go. There it is. See, I guess it's not a 20-foot pool. It's like more of a 10-foot pool.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
Callie's showing me a picture from the website.
Yeah. Of Stacy Robinson, a biologist that's out vaccinating monk seals.
Yeah. And, yeah. So I noticed up the front cover of one of the sciences is the red squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
That's another virus type thing problem. Have you?
I didn't get a chance to read that one. And I went to the monk seal because I had read about monk seals before.
Yeah, I remember, wasn't it around the British Isles there was a problem with some kind of a distemper in lots? Was it seals or was it dolphins?
No, it was seals.
Seals?
Yeah.
So that was like a couple of years ago, wasn't it? One more even? I don't remember.
I can't remember, but...
Yeah, so I did read the red squirrels one, but it was a little while ago. It was several days ago.
Okay.
And I didn't pick it up because I had no notes. I read it from the paper version. But just quickly, it's like, this is like a long time ago, gray squirrels were introduced to, can't remember, I think it's Ireland actually. Maybe it's UK. I mean, England proper. I don't remember. But anyway, and somehow there's been a virus introduced with the gray squirrels.
Oh.
And the red squirrels that are indigenous are catching it and dying. And they're basically able to stop it by calling the gray squirrel population.
Oh.
So it sounds to me like the virus is not adapted. I hope I'm remembering this correctly. This is several days ago and so much has happened between now and then. But anyway, it looks like they're having some success.
Wow.
Like in one area, they basically destroyed the gray squirrel population and the red squirrels are doing okay. I think.
I was interested in that one.
It's funny, when you look at the picture, their red squirrel is a squirrel that looks like a squirrel and everything. We think of a red squirrel totally different, because our red squirrels are, we think of the ones we've seen in the Adirondacks and stuff. They're a much smaller species.
Yeah. And really big noisemakers.
Oh, and very aggressive. Those guys.
They you feel like a bear is coming after
you.
And shake bushes and make sounds that sound like a much larger animal when you're hiking through the woods, which is a riot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway,
yeah. So I'm wondering what you looked at.
Okay, I'll let you choose, because you have so much more. Just what the three things are. So I have a CRISPR one. I have a physics, astronomy, spacecraft one. And I have a cancer immunity therapy type one.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know where that'll fit in yours.
Okay, I have one.
Is partially an ecology evolution one.
Okay, how about we do the CRISPR evolution one, and I have an evolution to follow.
Okay. So this is published out of MBio. It's a journal of the American Society for Microbiology. And it's about not our use of CRISPR. So CRISPR is used by bacteria in archaea to do viruses.
Right.
So you have the CRISPR sequence that gets transcribed. And then around it, you also have other proteins needed, like Cas proteins, which then bind to it. And you have other sequences that come from viruses or whatever, which are similar to what's in the spacer region in your CRISPR region, and your Cas protein or whatever it is, your local system, just cuts up everything that matches that sequence. So if you find viral RNA, you stick it in there as a bacterium, and then in the future, if you ever get attacked by that, you're going to cut it up. The funky thing, so I'll say where exactly it's from. So it's out of MBio, May, June 2016, volume 7, issue 3. I don't have a page number, but the authors are Caroline Chenard, Jennifer F. Worth, and Curtis A. Suttle. And the title is Viruses Infecting a Freshwater Filamentous Cyanobacterium Encode a Functional CRISPR Array and a Proteobacterial DNA Polymerase B. So what they found is they were looking at cyanobacteria and the viruses that infect them. And cyanobacteria are really important for ecology because they do so much nitrogen fixation and they form symbiotic relationships, because in poor environments, they get to fix the nitrogen, and then the plants or fungi use that and provide them with other resources, places to live, whatnot. Substrate anchoring, I guess, maybe, I don't know. So I guess these viruses, because they're important, they've been studied a lot, but more on a physiology, ecology level. No one's ever sequenced them. So these people sequenced a couple of them. Let me look up. Cyanophages A1 and N1, so that's Alpha 1 and November 1. And they infect the genus of cyanobacterium known as Nostoc, the Nostoc genus, and a particular strain, which I'm not going to go over. And one thing that's been curious is that CRISPR sequences that you find in bacteria and archaea, I guess they all have CRISPR. And up to, I can't remember what fraction of bacteria do, but pretty large fraction. When you look at the sequences of CRISPR and the Cas proteins in these different places, a lot of times they're more closely related to, than the genomes of the bacteria or the archaea. Which means that somehow you needed horizontal gene transfer.
Right.
This was so useful, it went across to another species horizontally. So what's transferring it? Could be a plasmid, could be a virus. But no one's ever seen this.
Right.
Well, when they sequenced these two cyanophages for the very first time, they found that the N1 encodes CRISPR. Okay, so this is a virus that in its genome has CRISPR.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's like a bacterium showing up in your body with its own code for an antibiotic.
Wow.
And I think the idea is that, number one, this provides evidence for the horizontal transfer, so it helps explain that, how the sequences are similar. But the other thing that's cool is, like, from the virus's point of view, so to speak, teleologically, you grab the CRISPR. If you somehow can be resistant to it, right, because it's not your sequence, you shove it in to a cyanobacterium that you just infected, and other phages that come to infect it get destroyed by the CRISPR you brought along with yourself.
Wow.
So you're protecting the host from other phages until you get around to killing it.
Wow.
To use its resources to then put. So I thought it was a really interesting. So you know how we're like so hot for CRISPR because it's just so amazing and everything. There's all these new concepts every week about how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out.
You didn't even have to go anywhere.
This evolution has been going on for, they say, several billion years because it's an archaea, right?
Yeah.
And the viruses. So here's the other sequence that's common. The polymerase B that's mentioned in the title is also found in both the N1 and the A1 viruses. It matches best a polymerase B sequence from proteobacteria.
Mm-hmm.
I don't exactly understand that, but that means basically it got it from a billion years, from like several billion years ago.
Wow.
So we're discovering CRISPR now, but the viruses discovered it, even though it was against viruses, the viruses as a technologically interesting thing to experiment with, they discovered it a couple billion years ago and they're using it on cyanobacteria, which is just amazingly cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a really cool article.
And that is.
I actually didn't read all of their research. I mostly read just their abstract and their intro that explained really well, you know, what they discovered, why it was important, and the intro
really cool.
Explained the background really well. So I thought that was awesome.
Wow. Well, my evolution one is a little different than yours.
Is that from the notes you sent?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's the likely hobbit ancestors lived 600,000 years ago, earlier than they thought. And
so those are the ones from the island of Flores. Wait, what do they call? I hate that everybody calls them hobbit. I'm sorry, I just can't stand it.
They are called Floresiensis. Yeah.
Floresiensis.
Yeah.
So it's the island of Flores, is that right?
Right.
I think that's what it's called. Flores.
And they're 20% smaller. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I'm just like, and they were first, a first skeleton was found in Liang Bua cave.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've been on the search for a long time find it.
Until now, that's the
until
only
now.
Place they've ever been seen, right?
And so, more recently, they found parts, more bones in that. And they, let me see.
So I don't know practically anything about this, but this is from a different site, right?
Yes.
That they just found.
Yes, it's a different site. So they've been looking for a while, but they moved to this different site, and they've gotten jaw fragments and teeth and skeletal fragment.
And what's the age? Because this is supposed to be...
So these were, they're securely dated at 7,000 years ago.
No, that can't be right.
700,000 years ago.
700,000, yeah. That makes more
sense. Hundreds of thousands of years earlier than the Hobbit, and they're 20% smaller.
See, that's... I mean, to me, that's huge, because I don't care what the archaeologists say, but the fact is, they come up with these claims and stuff, and there's been times in history where these fantastic claims have been made, or maybe not necessarily fantastic, right? And it's found either to be absolutely erroneous or even a hoax, right?
Right.
And I certainly didn't believe this was a hoax, but you find a single set of individuals all in one cave, and they all date to the same time. You have to wonder to yourself, how much of an anomaly is this, right?
Right.
And then they're finding, well, so is this, how much of a skeleton do they have, actually?
So they only have parts. They have fragments. And that's from an island of Java or Sulawesi. And, it's interesting because they had to bulldoze the first layer because of all the vegetation growth over the last, you know, thousands and thousands of years.
Wow. How did they know they were there?
Well,
not in the article, maybe.
It's not clear to me. It's like, and the fossils peek from the surface. So they had some fossils peek from the surface.
Okay.
And then the team dug through a swath of landscape wholesale, and they used like bulldozers, and they employed 120 students and local workers to sieve through tons of dirt.
Right.
And it went through 10 field seasons.
Wow.
So that's huge.
It's a lot of dirt.
Yeah, it's a lot of dirt. So finally, in the final season, 2014, their labor paid off. And there was a person who found a hominid tooth, a lower jaw, and some baby teeth, too. So...
Oh, wait a second. Is that your highlighted area?
Yeah.
Cranium,
yeah. Yeah, so they're getting...
So assuming that they can accurately get the size of the individual from that, which I suppose they can, that's what's really amazing to me, or not amazing, but so important. It's same type of individual, same species, also tiny little stature and stuff, from a different place at a different time.
Right.
So the first one can't just be an anomaly, like can't be a deformed family that just...
Right.
Right? It's got to be something that's extended over tens of thousands of years, or at least thousands of years.
Right. And so from their excavation and sieving through stuff, they found that the environment that these individuals would have lived in were savanna-like grasslands, and they were watered by a meandering stream and populated with pygmy elephants and giant rats, freshwater crocodiles, and carnivorous Komodo dragons.
Wow.
And so it's just, I kind of like that they gave us the environment they lived in, because it's like,
it
then you start to picture
exactly
what it could have been like.
Yeah.
And here's some things that I thought was interesting, and I didn't know this. The pygmy elephant and other diminutive-sized organisms, they quickly evolved to a smaller size in the process called island dwarfing.
Yeah, yeah.
That is known to affect vertebrates. And I didn't know about that.
You know, I think you might have forgotten.
Did I?
Well, I remember you did a fair bit of island biogeography.
Yeah.
And I remember you telling me at one point about the smaller sizes that happened.
Oh, okay. I had forgotten because I was like, wow, so they think maybe the diminutive size was due to the island adaptation as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Who knows? Now, there are some skeptics, and I didn't say, oh, there's people who agree with you, but because I didn't want to break where we're going. But
Do you know what they're skeptic about specifically? Yeah.
So they say this one, Robert D. Martin, and he's from the Field Museum in Chicago, Illinois. He said he won't be convinced that the hobbit's puny brain isn't pathological until a second skull emerges.
Yeah.
Okay. So he said he really needs to see a full second skull.
So it's a statistical
thing. Yeah, instead of just like an oddity within a population.
Yeah. Yeah.
So still, I hope it's not. It'd be so cool to have, you know, a population of 1 meter tall hominids. Yeah. It's just weird and wonderful.
Although those are two possibly different things.
Yeah.
700,000 years ago, that's a long time.
Yeah. Anyway, I just found it very interesting. And
oh, well, wait a second. Lucy is 1.3 million, right?
So they've compared those dates. Let me see.
Okay, down here.
Yeah.
You have emerging surprisingly soon after their ancestor. Homo erectus. Okay, so Lucy must be a lot older than that. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I got confused. Lucy must be, what, 3 million maybe?
Yeah. Well,
but
I'm not sure.
I mean, yeah, so Homo erectus starting, I don't know, the brain is starting to get bigger, but it's not huge in that time. Anyway.
Very interesting stuff.
Yeah, very cool.
Okay. And what else do you have?
I told you, you have to decide. You want cancer immunotherapy T cells, or do you want NASA telescopes, Jupiter?
NASA telescopes.
Okay, news piece. The CRISPR was the only science article, like original research I have.
Mm-hmm.
News piece from June 10th, Science. So we're still on the one you had. And, oh, sorry, no. You wanted the science, like the telescope. June 3rd. So, okay. So the top layer of the atmosphere of Jupiter is covered in haze. I don't exactly understand precisely what they mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's very hard to look through that. And, but sometimes they can.
Mm-hmm.
And they see sometimes ammonia. And sometimes that bubbles up through the haze, so they can see it right on the surface, I think. I'm not totally certain about all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1995, there was a spacecraft that went by, the Galileo spacecraft, and it dropped a probe into the atmosphere. And it kept sending back signals as it dropped. And it dropped, I don't know how many kilometers, but many.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds? Tens? Something like that. And as it dropped, it sent back its readings of what it was sensing, and then it got crushed. Temperature and pressure just got too great, and it stopped sending. And at the time, they thought that really deep there was a layer of water, and it never got to it.
Okay.
So that caused them to start to think about, well, you know, what's down there? Our theories are incorrect, I guess. And also, it didn't see much ammonia. But we know we saw ammonia every so often from the surface. So then one theory is, well, maybe it's very rare, the ammonia down there, and it just bubbles up when you get a storm, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the water's much lower than we thought. So I don't remember when this happened, but there's a telescope, a radio telescope called the Very Large Array, and it's in New Mexico. And it had looked in onto the surface, and it saw very little ammonia, but it couldn't reach down far, because also around Jupiter there's, you know, that gigantic magnetic, like a little bit like our Van Allen belts, I think. Mm-hmm. There's this huge magnetic field where you've got ions zipping back and forth.
Right.
And the wavelength that would be useful for peering underneath, which the VLA could use, I suppose, they can't make it through that.
Okay.
A large bandwidth of those measurements are blocked by this. Okay. And of course, we're not going to see the poles because we're in the same plane. So we have another probe going over there. Let me look up. It's called Juno. So Juno is the name of the spacecraft. And when it gets there, it's going to go into a crazy orbit. And let me see if I can find the picture. There's a picture on page 1156. And basically,
it looks like an ellipse.
Yeah, so it's going to come in, and you can imagine, if you imagine a little bit like Van Allen belts, mm-hmm, around the Earth, it looks similar, but they're humongous. They go way, way far out into space, like past where, you know, they go even further than some of the moons.
Right.
And so the probe, the spacecraft Juno, is going to come in. Let me see, inbound trajectory. It looks like it's coming in from the north, and it's going to come in through the pole, and it's going to zoom in close to Jupiter on the inside of the belt, and then it's going to start on this orbit that it keeps going back and forth, where it keeps coming in on the pole and then coming out again at the south pole, mm-hmm, and back and forth, hugely elliptical. And every time it passes, it's going to be between these belts and Jupiter. And those are the ones that are blocking the VLA from Earth in New Mexico.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to have the same type of instruments. It's going to be right up close, and it's going to be able to look really deep in.
Neat.
And one of the things that's really exciting with this probe going in is some people just did some fancy work, I think, with the VLA. It's in this article also. I'm not going to... I'd waste my time looking for it, so I'm not going to, but I think they used VLA, but they got an upgrade or something, or maybe, mm-hmm, they used something else, and they were able to probe slightly deeper than before.
Wow.
And what they found is, actually, this layer that we thought that's just below the haze, it's waves. And you have areas that are super hot, mm-hmm, of like, I don't know, tens of thousands of kilometers or thousands of kilometers, I don't know, and then areas that are not. So in the hot places, you don't have the water and the ammonia.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have another area where you have the water and the ammonia. And then you have another one where you don't again.
Mm-hmm.
And the probe that went in 1995 just by chance happened to drop in one of the hot areas.
Oh, okay.
So that's why it didn't measure ammonia,
right,
and water. And so we're going to get a much finer grained understanding of what's happening deep inside, and
it's
if there's
really
the
cool
water. Yeah. And it's going to tell us a lot about where Jupiter formed. Because, let me see if I'm going to try to get this right. Okay. If we find that there is tons of water and ammonia, and it's in the same concentration as, I think, nitrogen,
yep,
and carbon or oxygen.
If there's water abundance and they're very high relative to nitrogen and carbon.
Nitrogen and carbon. Okay, so if it's the same as the nitrogen and carbon, that means that the water and the ammonia and the carbon nitrogen froze together,
mm-hmm,
right? Because if it was hotter, then the carbon and the nitrogen would freeze out, but the hydrogen is so light, it wouldn't freeze, right? Mm-hmm. Or the water, I guess. Anyway, not the hydrogen, the water.
Right.
So if the amounts are similar, they froze together, which means Jupiter must have formed in a cold place, and that means it can't have formed where it is now, because that's too close to the Sun. Neat. And it would have migrated in. On the other hand, if you see a total imbalance and the ones that are more volatile are there, that means no, probably it formed where it is here because it was hot, so the volatile stuff didn't freeze out. Mm-hmm. Along with everything else. So, and there's also some information about how fast it froze, I think, mm-hmm. or formed. Anyway, and supposedly it's going to tell us about whether there's actually a solid core inside, which would help trap the volatile stuff. And
yeah.
So it looks like there's a ton of information coming out of this mission.
That's a really neat study. That'll be fun. Yeah. To learn more about.
Anyway, so that's my ground-based VLA out of New Mexico, ammonia waves and Jupiter and Juno spacecrafts story.
Okay. I have one. Oop, I don't have it up. No, this one. So I have one about carbon. It's a new solution for carbon.
Oh, darn. I saw that one also. I was really interesting. I never got a chance.
So we have some scientists in Iceland. It's actually French and U.S. scientists, I think. And they...
So this was published in June 10th this year?
Yes, June 10th.
Okay.
And what they've done is they force the carbon dioxide underground. And they forced it into igneous rock.
Uh-huh.
And when it was forced into igneous rock, it caused it to crystallize.
Cool.
And so we have this really, we have this capture system where the carbon dioxide is put into volcanic rock, and it triggers a reaction to rapidly form new carbonated minerals. So, really neat stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know,
but could they, that...
Well, I yeah, was go just going to go, okay, so, you know, they've been looking at different ways of capturing carbon and trying to disperse it in some ways. And the estimated cost of some of those is like $50 to $100 per ton, which would be incredible considering how much carbon dioxide that a company makes in a year, maybe even in a week, right? So they think that this may be an alternative, and they're going to be testing it more in the next little while. And it's kind of neat. The way they found it is they were pumping it down into the ground, and the engineers were getting really frustrated because their pumps kept on, you know, crudding up and stopped working.
Uh-huh.
And what they didn't realize is it's that reaction that was causing the minerals to crystallize the carbon dioxide gas into calcium carbonate. Anyway, so isn't that pretty cool?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
it sounds like it would be very much dependent on the geological formation of where you are, which makes it possibly limited in terms of applicability.
Yeah, so they don't know yet. Okay, so, if they're thinking of scaled up demonstration, could also make sure that the speed of the reaction won't turn into a drawback.
Yeah.
And
do you know where they were doing this?
So they were doing this near volcanic rock. So they were doing it near...
Is this it right there? Wallula, Washington? Or is that a different... I'm seeing Wallula, Washington right there. No, that's a different place. No. Different experiment.
So let's see.
Anyway. Doesn't really matter. I was just curious.
Oh, here. 25 meters east of Reykjavik.
So in Iceland.
Yeah.
25 kilometers.
Yeah.
East of Reykjavik. Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, I think in Iceland you wouldn't have a problem finding basalt.
Right. So, but it's just kind of interesting. I'm wondering where it's going to go, and it may give us another alternative that we just hadn't considered.
Sure.
So, neat article, and I'm looking forward to hearing how their scaled-up models go. Okay. Back to you.
Back to me? You know, this is my last one. I only have three.
That was all I had, too. Oh. It was my last one.
Okay. Okay, so this is about cancer and therapy and figuring out how T-cells respond to cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's out of the June 10th issue again, and I can't remember, Perspective, that's what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an original paper.
Okay.
I only looked at the, in Science, in the same issue, I only looked at the Perspective. Okay, so here's the thing. You get cancer,
mm-hmm.
and the cancerous cells, of course, they're starting to divide out of control in this tumor, and they start to mutate, mm-hmm. and the mutation rate goes through the roof. And a lot of these mutations show up in protein-coding regions. And the proteins gets translated and then transcribed, and then they get ripped apart in the cells and stuck on the major histocompatibility complex,
mm-hmm.
which shows up on the cell surface, and T cells recognize that. And the important thing to understand is if a peptide that you created does not show up bound to the MHC, the T cell is not going to destroy your cancer cell. It's not even going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's absolutely critical. For a long time, people thought, you know, these peptides being made by the tumor cells, they're really not being recognized by mm-hmm. the T cells. So they're not immunogenic for some reason. Maybe they don't bind to the MHC complex. Maybe it's something else. The reason is because T cells just don't go wild on tumor cells and destroy them. Or at least maybe they do sometimes, maybe a lot of times. But when we see a cancer show up and a person becomes a patient because they've got cancer, obviously the tumor grew. So the T cells didn't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was, well, these mutations are not immunogenic. This research is really exciting because it shows, actually, they maybe really are immunogenic. What's happening, possibly, so I'm going to skip ahead to some of the theory, is that the new theory is that there's two things. One is the environment inside the tumor
mm-hmm.
is somehow stopping some of the critical steps to activating the T cells. And some of the environment in the tumor maybe is actually suppressing the response in some other way. Like two possibilities that are fundamentally different, but all happening within the tumor. Okay, so what happened with this research? They took, I think, three patients that had melanoma,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and they took cells out of the tumor, and they did the genome analysis and looked for all of the places that had gotten mutations. And they got a whole bunch of hits. And out of all those hits, they used a computer program to see, well, which parts of... So first of all, they looked only for those sequences that were part of regions that would be translated and transcribed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, transcribed and then translated. So there should be a protein product with a mutation in it.
Right.
And then they fed that into their computer simulation to see, well, if you cut this up, what parts of it will bind to the MHC complex?
Right.
And out of all of their hits, they ended up with, 249 candidates, meaning there were proteins with mutations or peptides with mutations, and 57 that should have bound to the MHC class 1. Okay. Then they used some cells from healthy donors, T cells, mm-hmm. and they also got dendritic cells, which are another kind of immune cells, and they altered the dendritic cells with a whole bunch of these peptides that had been predicted to code mm-hmm. for the MHC. And they specifically used cells, if I remember correctly, that they had a similar MHC sequence, so that it should be compatible.
Okay.
And then in vitro, they put the two together. They put the T cells together with the dendritic cell. So the dendritic cell has stuck into it genes they put in that code for those extra immunogenic peptides. And the T cells come from healthy people. So they're naive right. in the sense they've never seen the tumor. So right. they haven't been affected by it. And out of the 57, 11 of them reacted strongly with the T cells. In other words, the T cells went wild on the dendritic cells and just totally activated themselves, were ready to kill anything they saw. So that's a way higher fraction than T cells you isolate from the tumors.
Yeah.
And those T cells went there because they, presumably, because they're binding to stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the message is, yeah, this is a valid target for us to mm-hmm. attack, because there is a lot of immunogenicity there. It's just somehow the native T cells from the patients aren't recognizing it. Now, there's these different possibilities with, you know, which could be categorized into sub-possibilities that are more complicated. But the basic idea is that if, so they don't know from their experiment whether there's something wrong with the T cells before they encountered the tumor in the patients, right? Because that's not something they tested.
Right.
But the idea is, if those T cells are perfectly fine, then when they enter the tumor, something happens. And if the priming of the T cell, meaning that initial, I don't know exactly what priming is actually, but I'm mm-hmm. guessing it's the initial presentation, is stopped in the tumor because of the environment of the tumor, then what you could do is you could take some peptides mm-hmm. from the person who's got the tumor. Like, so you biopsy the tumor, mm-hmm. find out what's mutated, make the peptides, and inject it into the person. So it's all over the body. It's not just in the tumor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that person should have a bunch of T cells that will really
react
to that. And then when they see the tumor, they're already primed. So they should take it down, or at least attack a lot of the cells there. The other thing you could do is, what if it's a step further down?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could take T cells from the individuals, and you could present them with it outside the body and re-inject the T cells after you expanded them. So you've got a lot of them. And then those T cells are way further down the line to being aggressive towards your tumor than if you had just injected the peptides in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, I don't know. I thought it was really interesting. You know, it's all of these types of things are like complex problems that you require really complicated experiments to get at it. And of
right.
course, any kind of therapy like this, trying to figure out how to get it to work, is going to take a lot.
It is.
But once you have it down,
yeah,
and you have a system for, you know, yes, it's going to be individual, so it's going to be a little bit more complicated, or maybe a lot more complicated. But once you set up system to do high throughput screening and high throughput
right.
expansion of cells, you can set up a system that this is something that you could do for people.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. I thought it was very interesting.
Not unlike stem cell therapies that they use now.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Right, because they do that right now.
Right.
Take people's own stem cells and
mm-hmm.
expand them. So.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. Nice.
I love also especially the situation where there's something that we've thought for a long time, you know, you take T cells from the tumors and they're just not reacting. And, well, you know, there's not much yeah, there's all these mutations, but somehow they're not immunogenic. And this actually shows no. If you take a much more careful approach, isolating naive T cells and making sure you're screening for the right mutations, you find really there's a lot there. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
very nice.
And that is all I have.
Well, that's all the articles that I covered this week too.
Okay.
There are a few things I wanted to mention. First up, I wanted to mention that Patrick made contact with all the schools.
Yeah, that was a lot of work.
Which is a huge undertaking, just to get people at the end of the year when they're having to clean up,
you know,
handing grades and that. And
at least one lady, I said, yeah, I know it's end of the year, it's difficult. Although from our point of view, it made a lot of sense. She was like, no, this is the perfect time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she was like, this is the time to contact people and stuff so they can be, ready thinking about it.
Nice.
So, yeah.
I always hoped that they would feel that way and not just kind of like right at the door.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely the people that thought that I wanted to talk to students now thought that was a bad idea. And that was somehow I gave that impression in some of my emails. That was a mistake. I don't know how it happened. But it's not just one person that thought that, so somehow I worded it in a poor way.
Yeah.
So we're ready to go with every single school when the fall comes around again.
Mm-hmm. So. And that trying to forethink what's going to happen in the fall and getting ready for that is part of what I wrote my blog about.
Oh, was it?
Thinking about the makerspace for next year.
Cool.
And where to go with it. And I'm back down to maybe more succinct lessons so the kids build experience, and then more of those, and with a little bit of time for them to explore on their own for a few weeks after they've built a bit of experience.
By the way, talking about this... our plans for next year for the ARDF.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I've been following the discussion on the email list for the ARDF in the United States. And there's been fantastic discussions going on about how we should interpret the rules, what rules do we have or really not have in the U.S., and how to get people more interested, and also information coming from people that are actually working with kids. The one that comes mostly to mind, which seems right now is doing the most, is Brian Coleman. He's in Colorado, and he's not working in the schools, but he's working with kids. And I didn't realize, I just found out, he started off doing 2-meter stuff.
Wow.
So, yeah, we're not there yet.
No.
I want to talk about that before we leave.
Okay, so, and that leads to the next thing.
That does? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're pretty far along with the 80-meter stuff. I had one failure on one of the PCBs, which might never get finished, but we're up to 8 transmitters, and I have the next order set, and there was very little change in the PCB that got sent to Oshpart. So after this, one more order, and we're done.
That's nice.
And we can do sprints. So, but the big failure has been trying to get the 2-meter stuff going. And we've been busy and we've had stuff happen, so I haven't worked at it a super amount. But I've done several trials already with the SI-5351. And I hit a problem somewhere around 110 to 120 megahertz, where it just goes crazy above that, and I stopped getting a regular waveform, and I just switched out our board with the Adafruit breakout instead yesterday, and I was testing, I think, at 145 megahertz. Mm-hmm. Which we need for 2-meter, and I was not getting the right value out. So I'm using libraries that I've gotten off the internet, and which are pretty old, and I think the main person that worked on it actually started working on an Arduino library before it was really completed. And I guess I'll try the Arduino next. I mean, what's really upsetting is, like, everything is failing in a different way, so I don't have a clear, this is the one that's wrong, or the Adafruit one, the waveform coming from it does not look like it does from ours. And I don't, it's just upsetting to not have a clear answer one way or the other. Anyway, yeah, I think next I'll try the Arduino and see. I really hope it works.
Oh, and the other thing, last week we went to see a talk.
Oh, I totally forgot about that. Yeah.
I forgot to mention
Maniacal Labs.
Yeah, Maniacal Labs.
Trilog.
Trilog meeting.
The Triangle and Linux Users Group in, well, it's out of NC State, really, right, in Raleigh.
Right. Interesting partnership, two people who.
What are the names? I'll look it up.
Yeah,
go ahead.
You can look up the
names. I have it in my notes.
Basically, they both have fun messing around with LEDs and trying to get them to do all kinds of things.
And we're talking about major displays.
Oh, yes, major displays. So, but it started with just them both trying to figure out how to use LEDs. That's why we're starting with. And now they're like, they've been contracted to make, you know, 8-foot Tetris games and things like that.
I know.
So they're very complex, not the, you know.
So it's Adam,
where they started.
Adam Haile, H-A-I-L-E, and Daniel Ternes, T-E-R-N-E-S. Do you remember who's who?
No. But anyway, one's the electrician, one's a computer programmer.
I think one's an electronics engineer.
Oh, sorry. Yes, you're right. Electronics engineer. Pardon me. That
one's a hardware guy. One's a software
guy. That's what I was thinking. Okay. But when Pat was lamenting about this not working or maybe working, but I can't figure it out, they talk about having to set up a prototype, and then after you get the prototype, is trying to get it built to the specs that you wanted or expected. And working with, you know, China and groups in China to make that happen. And it just being difficult.
And their main thing is selling controllers for LED, RGB LED strips. And you have two main ones. I think one's called All Pixel and the other one Long Pixel. And they have other products, but those are their two they do. Their main ones, and one of them is just regular LED strips, and then the other one is what they call analog, which are way more powerful, but you need to drive them.
I found it just very interesting to see people go through the building marketing process, and they're still learning. They know they're still learning, and just to have such open-mindedness about the whole process. And be like, you know, this is what we're doing because we enjoy it. And, you know, it'd be nice for it to pay for itself. And that would be a great goal to have. And, you know, that's what they're hoping for.
People that show up at the talks in that group really have, a lot of them have that open-mindedness. And the reason they're able to get as far as they can is because they're using stuff that's open, right?
Oh, yeah.
And they're using it to learn it and stuff. And so it's really
cool. And
trying
to support it, too. And,
well, that's like, the point is, because they're trying to support it, they're giving back and making it possible for the next generation.
Right. So they aren't just taking from the community, but trying to build in their own way. I thought that was excellent. In fact, we will be buying from them soon.
For Isaac and Luke.
I
know, that was a great idea.
So,
and every year we come to a point, it's like, what are we going to get this year? It's going to be a lot of fun. And,
yeah.
And so Sphero was the last one.
Yeah.
That would, okay.
It was okay. I think this will be much more interesting to them because...
It'll be fun to have LEDs all over the place going with different patterns.
And, right. And also, it's just, it's cool to fund a local group who's in a startup.
Yeah.
And I just think that's interesting.
Yeah.
And
Well, they have day jobs.
Yeah, they do.
They're doing all of this on their own time, which is just amazing.
You know, I can
amazing,
see Isaac and Luke getting into odd things like
this.
Definitely. And so that's why I wanted to get something for Isaac and Luke from them.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Are we good?
It is time to wrap up.
Okay, let me go to the notes. Thank you for listening to the Island CD podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.